I'm Mary McCormick, and you're listening to Pod Clubhouse.
Pod Clubhouse.
Stoke the Rabidity! Stoke! Stoke!
This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Duffy Wrestling Dirt Sheet, a Heels podcast. Tonight we're talking about episode 3 of Heels. It's called Cheap Heat. New blood on the scene here today, Caroline. We've got written by Bradley Paul and directed by Jessica Lowry. The first episode not being written by Michael Waldron, the series creator, or directed by Peter Siegel. So
you don't get an opportunity to say his name another way.
I did. And if you don't think I didn't work it in there, just so I had a chance to give another reading, and I did. I went with Peter Siegel. So
I love it.
Yeah. I'm working it out. I'm working on the gimmick on how to say his name. You guys are watching. The sausage get made here, so good for you.
Oh my goodness. All right, so give us a little wrestling terms corner here, because Cheap Heat seemed like something that I should know from wrestling, but of course I didn't. So I was like, okay, what do I think this means? My gut instinct, okay, and now you have to tell me if I'm right. My gut instinct was like, that's when you were like bringing in like a ringer, but I don't know exactly. So tell me a little bit about Cheap Heat.
So the idea of heat, it has kind of two meanings. Heat is either getting a negative reaction from the crowd, getting boos, you know, like when Ace comes backstage and he's all pissed off and he's throwing chairs and he's yelling at Jack about the crowd booing, you know, and Jack tells him, like, you know, generating heat's your fucking job, that kind of thing. That is heat as it's traditionally understood, is getting a negative reaction from the crowd, which is what a heel wants. If a face or a baby face wants to get a pop, a cheer from the crowd, a heel is looking for heat from the crowd, the complete opposite.
Okay.
Cheap heat is manufacturing that heat. It's not enough to just be a heel. It's like you go in the, like if you're doing a match in New York City and you say, you know, the Knicks suck and the Yankees suck and the Mets suck and the Giants suck and the Jets suck. All your teams suck and, you know, you suck. That is cheap heat, because that's always going to get a loud reaction from the crowd. It's like if you were a face and you go into the crowd and be like, this is my favorite place in the world. And the crowd goes, oh, I love you. That's a cheap pop, you know. So cheap heat is like, is getting like an easy incitement to booing.
Okay, so how does that apply to this episode?
My feeling was the throwing of the tissues, the manufacturing of the tissues in order to force Ace's kind of negative reaction and the crybaby chants. It was kind of like reverse heat. By putting the tissues on there, it was manufacturing that they were going to, the crowd knew what to do with the tissues. They didn't need to be told when they found tissues and they found Ace in the ring. You know, they were able to put the two and two together and get four. And so I think the cheap heat was Jack kind of manipulating the situation, really manufacturing the crybaby chants and the throwing of the tissues against Ace, that negative turn against Ace, who up until now, we understand in the show, has always been the face of the DWL.
Were you surprised that Jack like would actually plant those tissues there? I mean, was that like a whoa, like, I mean, he's going pretty far here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm impressed a little bit. Willie calls him on it at the end of the episode. He says he would have gotten there anyway, but I mean, would he? I mean, he was pretty set on the fact that he didn't want to be booed, right? He had his whole, it's this conversation right here.
When I'm out there, there's no difference between hate and love, so long as they're doing something.
Of course you're okay with people hating you, Jack. It comes naturally.
Listen to me, little shit. You're fucking amateur hour out there, because you don't understand the difference between cheering and booing and generating heat. Generating heat is your fucking job. You'd make a really good heel, Ace.
What? Hey, get your fucking hands off
me. What is wrong with being a heel?
You're the fucking heel. I'm the fucking face. Dad was a face. Get that through your fucking head.
Dad was a face. Tom Spade was a face. All right, yeah, no, because he was a good guy. He was a real good guy. He knew that you were home.
I mean, this is really an extension of the conversation that Jack is having with Big Jim in the end of the first episode. These faces don't want to be booed. They don't want to be thought of as bad guys because they've wrapped their identity up in it. And Jack is trying to convince him, this is acting. What the fuck does it matter? If they're yelling or they're screaming, it's all the same. It's the reaction that you care about, not what the specific reaction is.
I feel like, though, because of episode one and we understand so much about how they have to stay in character, I get it why it would be beyond the ring. You know, it's like, well, if I'm a heel, I have to be like a crappy guy all the time. You know, I have to be doing stuff in the town and at the church picnic, or I can't even go to the church picnic, or all those things. Like, it really does affect your whole life beyond just like the self-esteem beating you have to take in the ring.
Well, here's the thing, though. Ace is kind of a piece of shit, though, in real life, though.
We know that, but he doesn't think
exactly.
That.
This is all part of delusion. I want to play this clip because this all goes towards Ace and the delusions he has about himself. This is from earlier in the episode when he's talking about his apology promo when he's working on it and the changes he wants to make to it.
And the next thing is, at the very end, instead of saying this is the beginning of my story, I should just say, because good always, always triumphs over evil.
But doesn't.
Don't what?
Always triumph over evil.
The fuck you talking about?
If you're changing the line in the speech, it's going to land false with the crowd because they know it's bullshit.
Good triumphing over evil is a commonly held belief, Jack.
It's not true, Ace. Evil's got a fuck ton in the trophy case.
In the end, good always triumphs over evil.
In the end.
One, I love the line, evil's got a fuck ton in the trophy case. I think that is a great line. I may put that on a pillow. Ace sees himself as like this superhero. He really sees himself that way. And he completely skips over the fact that he comes backstage and he calls Willie a bitch. And he pushes Crystal out of the way and says, we're not dating and you're disgusting, or whatever he says to her. You know, he makes Helen Cooper cry in the first episode by calling her fat. She might eat her dog. Like,
right.
Ace doesn't have any sense of who he is or how the world perceives him. So he is honestly the most natural heel ever, because he really is just not a good guy. I mean, it's the easiest kayfabe if he's just who he naturally is, banging different women every night, pissing and you know, in the yard, drinking.
On God's grass.
On God's grounds, you know. And granted, maybe God's fault for making him have to piss, but like throwing beer bottles. Like, Ace, everything Ace has done outside of the ring is natural heel kayfabe. Like, it's the easiest thing in the world. He just has to be himself now.
Yeah, I just, you know, he just doesn't see himself like that, you know, yeah. And so I can see where he's like, what do you like? I could see where he was like, how would I even act like a heel in public? Oh, I don't even know what I am supposed to do. Just be yourself.
So in the beginning, he's doing this apology promo, and Crystal, who I give Crystal a lot of credit, she has a lot more confidence in this episode. She's speaking her mind a lot more, it seems like. And she says to Ace, isn't this promo a little too positive? Isn't it a little too, you know, fucking cheery? And then later on she says, well, maybe you'll get booed, right? When Ace is talking to Jack about the way it's going to go down tonight after the Rookie Rabies match. So she's pushing this, you're going to be booed and maybe you should be a heel. You have Jack pushing the heel line and manufacturing the cheap heat with the tissues and the crybaby chant. And then you have this clip with Rooster later on.
Now, one thing Jack is right about is you become a heel. Come on, you a face. That dog won't hunt. Not now. You cried in the rain.
I didn't feel
it. No. You cried in the rain.
Ouch.
Could you pinpoint a moment? Which one of these do you think is what finally pushes him over the edge? Or is it really just the totality of literally every person coming up to him and being like, dude, you're a piece of shit. You should be a heel.
I mean, I think the weightiest comment was definitely Rooster. It was holding the mirror up. He doesn't know what he looks like to everybody else. He doesn't have a good sense of self. So when Rooster's like, no, I'm going to tell you what the rest of us saw and how we're looking at you. To me, that was like the weightiest comment. But for sure, I mean, when you have Crystal, Jack, and Rooster, I mean, who else is even in his life? His mom needs to come talk to him. That would be about it, right? These are all the people of his world.
I give Ace a lot of credit for trusting Bobby to change that match on the fly. Because Ace, I mean, again, natural talent, but we now know doesn't have the most experience. I mean, Jack, even in the clip we played earlier, calls him like amateur hour. And Bobby, who literally doesn't know what the fuck he's doing in the ring. And they're going to call this match, this character changing, character defining match, where he's going to turn heel in the middle of the match. Ace is putting a lot of trust in Bobby being able to roll with it.
And safety-wise, it's super important that, like, you know, these two people really are on the same page. And so for Ace to be just calling out things and being pretty new, and Bobby being extremely new, they're very lucky that nothing bad happened.
Yeah, he's great. And you know what? I love the fact that they show the ball shot, like, you know, what the Stacy's friend calls the donkey kick. I love that because that, you know, and you, for those that aren't, like, you know, up on what good guys can do in the ring and what bad guys can do in the ring, you have the audience member, you know, shout down, "That's a heel move," you know. But he's right though. Like, good guys don't kick their opponents in the balls. They don't do cheap shots. They don't rake the eyes like you see Vicky Valet do during the Ricky Rabies match. Like, they don't do that. They don't do illegal moves. And it's a very white hat, black hat kind of way of understanding the rules of wrestling and the roles people are playing. So I love that the show shows us that, and they really telegraph it. When he goes to pin him and then he picks his head up, he's like, "I'm not done with him yet." Ace does a great heel turn here, and it's great. And I absolutely love it. But here's the thing, you know, afterwards, and he's all pissed off about it. Like, he's done this great match. I mean, he gets a standing ovation essentially from the locker room, and he's so fucking angry. What's going to make Ace happy, Caroline? What? He's finally got people cheering for him in the locker room, really happy about him, and he's still pissed off. He calls Willie a bitch. I don't think you should call Willie a bitch, Caroline.
I don't think you should ever call Willie a bitch. No, I think that was a very bad move. I don't think anyone knows what's going to make Ace happy. I mean, that's going to be the question for the ages on this one. Beyond everything, though, he wanted to be like a superhero. He wanted to be Superman. He doesn't want to be the most loved villain. He wants to be the most loved superhero. So it doesn't really matter to him how big the crowd gets over being a villain. He just doesn't see himself that way. And you know, I don't know when you have this whole kayfabe part, like, I don't know how it would mess with you. And especially he's really, we talked about this in our last episode. He talks about black hole stuff, you know, like, I don't know that he's has some demons in there that we definitely need to sort out.
Well, and I think that's a natural segue to talking about King Tom Spade, who opens this episode in that flashback.
Holy crap, Mike, what the hell? I did not see that coming at all.
And I think as we talk about this, we can't forget the part of Jack's little tantrum or a little scolding that he gives Ace, that dad, yes, dad was a good guy, dad was a face, dad also knew you were home, as he whispers to him conspiratorially, which says a whole lot. I think there's a lot of Ace and Tom that that apple and that tree are very close together, which makes me worry about Ace a little bit, I'll tell you the truth. But let's get into this opening scene and this flashback. What's your takeaway from Tom killing himself? I mean, there's no other way to say it.
So first I want to say from the outset here that Mike and I are not mental health professionals. And so we're going to discuss this suicide pertaining to just this character and just what we think was going on in this episode. But of course, every situation is completely different. So in this case, there's so much going on there. And they did such a great job setting up that scene where my heart was racing. There was tension building as he was moving along, and which seems kind of odd because it was like he seemed to be doing these chores. He seemed to be getting everything done on his to-do list and everything seemed to be on the up and up. But when he saw the deer and he just like stalked into the house, I was like dreading this next moment, but I was dreading it for all the wrong reasons. I thought surely he's going to blow this deer's head off and I'm going to have to see this. And instead he shoots himself. And so I give the writers so much credit for how they set this up, because they gave me all the right tension and all the right emotions, but I didn't see it coming, which is pretty amazing. Did you realize what was going to happen there in that moment?
No, I thought for sure, same as you, is he saw that. Well, when he sees the deer and he has that look after we've watched him run past the dome, run through the town, run past the faded billboard of his glory days, wave to everyone in the town. Like, Tom Spade is a known person, just like his sons are kind of now. You know, working his land, drinking the hose, the well. Like, this is a beautiful piece of property. It's a gorgeous day down in Duffy, Georgia. He sees the deer. And so my reaction was what I think his reaction was, fucking deer ruining my goddamn garden. I just perfected Carol's garden. So yeah. He goes and gets a gun. I'm like, oh, he's going to shoot the fucking deer. So I was shocked. And there was no hesitation when he brings the gun up to his chin. I mean, yeah. I kind of, like, you know, as I always do, I made fists and I put them up by like my like temples, which is always like my go to like scary face. But I had no time to react, really. Right. There's no hesitation when he finally does it. There's no hesitation to it, which I think is interesting. So there's two theories you and I have been talking about since we both watched this episode. One is he checked off all of his bucket list items and this was all that was left to do. Like, he got everything as ready as he could be, and now it's time to make his final exit. I don't like that one, but I think that's definitely a theory people are going to talk about. And then there's the other theory, that when someone finally literally pulls the trigger on themselves, it's often not a question of the if they've made the decision to do it. I have personal experience with this. I had an uncle who committed suicide. There were many false attempts. My mother was often talking to him on the phone. She would talk him down. When he finally killed himself, he didn't call my mother beforehand. So there were many false attempts where he wanted to be talked off the ledge. And when he finally committed to it, he didn't reach out to my mother to stop himself, and he just did it. He didn't do it on a porch. He did it in a camper bag behind his house, but still with a gun. Very similar situation. Very, very sad, but he was committed to doing it, and there was no longer hesitation there. But what the actual final thing is that makes you get up and do that, I think that is unpredictable. It's the when that becomes unpredictable. So for me, it was the deer ruining this idyllic paradise. What's your take? Why now? Why this way at this time?
You know, like you said, we discussed the two different theories, and I won't completely set aside the one where everything was just as beautiful as it could be. You know, like, he was out in nature, everything had been done off his list. He felt somewhat at peace, I guess. But the stalking through the house to me is the part where I lean more towards the other theory. He didn't just like casually bring a gun up out of his pocket and kill himself. He like stalked into the house, and like the way he was like striding through the, like, he was angry. He was angry to me. So for me, the deer represents this futility of everything he's doing. No matter how hard he works, no matter how perfect a scenario can be, still something can come out of the woods and get you. And so that futility, that feeling of like, it's never, ever going to be good enough, I can never make it perfect, that feeling to me is what snapped him. He just was so pissed. He was tired of blowing the heads off of deer, and he just decided to do it to himself. I know that there's many people who do plan out their suicide, you know, suicide notes, giving away their things, doing all those things. I think running through town and waving at everyone could be perceived as like somewhat of a, you know, saying goodbye to people in some way. You know, there's a lot to read into that. I want to get to the end portion, though, about the fact that Ace was home and that he's the one that found him. We had talked about Neil from Kevin Can F himself. In that, we said, you know, he found his mom dead at a young age, and that it really messed him up. And I do think that Ace, obviously, I mean, he's a grown man who comes out with a blanket around his shoulders like an old nana. And so there's question marks with me about Ace. You know, he wasn't out there helping Dad do anything. He wasn't out there, you know, raking or cleaning or building or anything. He was like, you know, wound up in his blanket in his room.
He's like a grown guy who lives in his mom's basement, essentially. I mean, we make fun of the nerd template of Ace every day in pop culture. It's just that right. He's super athletic, you know, and boning chicks in his bedroom instead of playing, you know, conspiracy theory video game guy in his mom's basement. But he's essentially the same person, right?
I can't decide if Jack's line of he knew you were home is like a, so Dad was trying to be a dick to you, or like, you need to stop thinking Dad was such a good guy because he put you in this position.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure which way Jack was 100% going. The way we're reading it, where this was just like the straw that breaks the camel's back kind of moment. In that case, I really do feel like it didn't matter that Ace was home. It wasn't a jab at Ace. It wasn't like a careless, oh, I know Ace is home, but I don't give a shit if he finds me. Like, I don't even think any of that was going through his mind. I really do think the futility of the situation, that you can work as hard as you ever can all day long, and still things can get ruined for you.
I also am not so sure how prevalent the idea that Ace was home was on Tom's mind in that moment, though there is some thought here. It's not like he went into the bedroom, grabbed his gun, and then shot himself in the bedroom. He went into the bedroom, stalked through the house, went to the drawer, got the gun out, then went back outside to the porch and took his life there, which is... I don't want to say polite, but it's a more thoughtful way of doing it. It doesn't, his wife, Mama Spade, would never be able to sleep in that bedroom again if he had killed himself there. That house would have been ruined in an utterly the irredeemable way, probably. You know, there's something about killing yourself where you're going to fall into the grass. Most of your blood's going to go into the grass. There's the return to the earth kind of aspect to it, which, I mean, may sound silly, but I think there's some forethought there.
I agree with you, which that's the planning part, right? Like, and making sure that every single thing is done on his list, you know, that Carol's garden sign is just so, and that everything is just right. Wanting to leave it as beautiful as he can for the rest of the family. If anyone he was thinking about, I'm going to say he was thinking about Carol.
Yeah,
and killing himself outside, like you said, so that she didn't have anything to clean up. I mean, I think that that's a huge part of it. But then you saw him giving the TLC to her stuff.
But that does maybe also lend support to the fact that he knew Ace was home. So Ace would be the one to find the body, not Carol. Right.
Exactly,
that he would be much more concerned about Carol's reaction to finding his body and having to clean it up versus Ace. So, I mean, Jack could have been home maybe just as easily as Ace could have been home. But as long as it wasn't Carol was probably the bigger thought on his mind.
I like that better. And I think that that's where there's a lot of these lines that come up in these episodes where you can take it multiple ways.
Right.
You know, saying, you know, he knew you were home. You can say that in a hissing way, or we can all look at it like, yeah, he knew you were home and not mom. And so therefore, you know, he was actually trying to spare her feelings. You know, like you can look at it in different ways. But I mean, obviously,
we can't ask Tom. And so we're never going to
know. Yeah, we're never going to know. And I also think that that's where the multi-meanings of the episode titles, you know, Cheap Heat, it also kind of reminds me of like a cheap shot generally.
It does.
And I think that that's what like all of this stuff between Jack and Ace, there's so many cheap shots taken. What a shock though, right?
Yeah.
What a shock to see that happen. However, I do want to give us like a lot of credit that like we had said there was something disgraceful and shameful about his death.
Not that suicide is...
No. I'm not saying that, but right. families can feel like...
That, I mean, they have kind of intimated already that, I mean, I think Ace, when him and Jack are choking each other in a gorilla in like the pre-stage area before going after the match, Ace even says to him, and one day you'll kill yourself just like Dad, and then they start choking each other. So we knew, I mean, without saying explicitly, we knew that Tom Spade's death was under a cloud of mystery and shame the way they were perceiving it. Watching it now, you definitely get a feeling of why, without answers. Was he sick? We don't know. It doesn't seem like he was terminal. So why? Why do this to your family? And so I think it makes a lot of sense. The natural anger Jack would have in particular would be an angry view of his father's suicide, not a sympathetic one, not yet anyway.
Well, to be left behind, to have to shoulder the responsibility of the business, his mom, the house, the bills, everything. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who have the mindset of, you know, that it is cheap to head out, you know, and leave everybody else responsible for all this stuff, all the fallout. It's horrible, the whole thing. And I'm so sad for Tom that he was in this mental state. It's clear to me that the family has depression in the family. I mean, obviously, they've shown this with Ace very clearly. He wants to mirror Tom. And so I can imagine that there's a lot of different things that Tom was going through throughout the years.
Before we leave Tom, and because we've spent a lot of time talking about the similarities between Ace and Tom, and like you just said, the way Ace patterns himself after Tom, you know, he was a face, but he was a face in the world. But remember, think of that Helen Cooper story. Ace found it funny, but it was actually Tom saying, probably the best thing for the dog, you know, because she probably would have eaten it. That wasn't Ace saying it as a kid. That was their father. So Ace and Tom really do seem very similar in so many ways. This face, this public persona mask of being the good guy, the baby face, but in private, maybe being, you know, a bit of an asshole, saying nasty things about the people who are coming to see them and paying over their hard-earned money to watch them wrestle. You know, we know from last week's episode, Tom was, you know, an alcoholic who was, it seems at least, was abusive in a verbal, if not physical way, but probably a physical abuse kind of way to some group of the boys or Carol. Tom Spade wearing the masks, right? This is how we started this show, talking about kayfabe. These idea of public personas versus who we really are, they are not necessarily the same. Very often are not the same. And so Ace very much seems like he's on the same trajectory. Everything we saw of Ace tonight backstage, when he takes the mask off, really seems to mimic Tom. But I was blown away by the end shot of this episode, where Stacy and Jack have had their fight, which we'll get to in a little bit, but I want to, this is the Tom angle of it. Stacy goes inside to get Thomas, who is asleep in Ace's bed. Jack follows. He's standing in the doorway. He's got his hands up on the bedroom door. The camera pulls back, and it's in Tom Spade's room, Tom and Carol Spade's room, showing us the dresser in the very near foreground where he grabbed the gun. The camera's in the same position as it was when he grabbed the gun at the beginning of the episode, but it's showing Jack through the door, looking at his wife and child. He stalks off. He goes through the house, the same final journey that his father took, through the closed-in screen porch, onto the stoop. He doesn't have a gun. He doesn't kill himself. But in the same spot where his father took his life, he begins to cry. And it struck me, and I'm curious what you think about this, this may be the first time Jack has actually cried since his father has died.
There's so much going on with Jack and so much going on with, I think, you know, obviously he named his son after Tom. There's so much, I think, that he would have wanted to share with dad and with his son, and to have to kind of realize, like, this is just isn't going to happen anymore the way that it was supposed to in his mind. I could see where that was a real breaking point for him to just finally feel not just the loss of his dad, but the loss of, like, all of what could have been.
Right. And we've been talking about, and Stacy even says to her friends, giving a little bit of exposition, that Jack has been having a real hard time of it the last year since his father died. She was talking about in the context of taking over the wrestling, which it sounds like Jack maybe was a wrestler, but definitely didn't do any of the business side of it beforehand, the way they're talking in that conversation with her friends. And then we've been talking about how Jack seems like he's just stretched everywhere and is kind of failing everywhere because nothing is getting his full attention. I want to call attention to one thing. After Stacy has that brutal line about, you know, how her friends get to pull away, you know, get to walk away and stuff, she walks away. A song cues up, the final closing song. It's called Yamaha by Delta Spirit. How maybe it's talking about Jack, how he's kind of abandoning Stacy and putting her through hell, and he's just not being accessible to her. But listen to these lyrics. It says, "There's a thousand things I will not understand, how you dealing with the hell I put you through. If I had my way, I would be right there next to you. There's certain things in life you cannot change. There's certain things I hope you know I care." Watching that scene and watching him kind of recreate his father's final journey through his house while that song is playing, with those lyrics of, "I fucked up, I hope you know I care, even though maybe I didn't show you I do." It was a really interesting kind of juxtaposition that maybe the song is actually talking about his relationship with his father. Because at the same time, remember, you have Ace. The final shot of Ace is that he's sitting on the ground at presumably his father's headstone in a cemetery somewhere. These boys are dealing with grief. And I guess that was where I wanted to talk to this a little bit longer, was grief is weird. Grief is not predictable. Grief is tricky. Grief can be a real son of a bitch because everyone deals with it so differently and there is no timetable on it. I think what we're seeing here in this episode, and what we've probably been seeing all three episodes so far, is that these Spade boys and their family, and by extension their extended family, are all still grieving and not doing a great job of it because they're neither not letting themselves feel their emotions or, you know, or pushing them down because they think they have to worry about other things. Is this us watching them really begin the grieving process for the first time, do you think?
It's one of those things that unfortunately kind of comes in waves. And so I think we're in a big wave portion right now where there's a lot going on and they're really trying to deal with the business. And having Ace almost get poached, I think that there's just like this another wave that came upon this group, this, you know, whether he would be taken away as well. Jack is dealing with so much. For Ace, man, I want to talk about the writing and the basis for like their names and everything that's going on, because I was fascinated with this whole concept of him being Ace Spade. When I was really thinking about it, Ace is either an extremely high card or an extremely low card. Him being either super high or super low matches so well to who he is. And then the idea of like the combination of an ace and a jack is like perfect blackjack. There's something about that is like they have to work together. They have to figure this out together. Even just their last name, that the spade is like the highest card in all of the deck. and the different suits. And there was just so much to it. This idea that it's like a house of cards that could fall apart at any time. But then it's all like how you play your cards in life. And there was just so much going on with this that I was really feeling it during these scenes, because I was trying to analyze, like, who are these men and what other information have they given us to understand who they are? The highs and lows of the ace really like was like, yes, this makes so much more sense now.
The challenge for the viewer in a good way is we're dropping in really in media res in these people's lives in the middle of a really, really difficult time. None of them, or at least none of the men, are emotionally mature enough to really be dealing with what they're dealing with. I mean, the loss of a parent is always difficult. I don't know at what age you're ever going to be ready to deal with the loss of your parent, because they play such important roles in our lives. But these guys in particular,
I'm going to throw forth the idea that I think that Tom was such a bigger than life, larger than life, like a patriarch of the family, that nobody could be a man if Tom's there. He is the man, and there's no one else a man. All the rest of them are boys, and you can never be a man. He didn't leave room for other men to be in the room. It was just him and then the rest of your boys. So I don't think until their father had passed on that they were ever going to take that step up. For Ace, I think it's a long, long stairway to get up to true manhood. But even for Jack, I mean, he's a husband, he's a father. And yet there's nothing about him that seems the same level of like father with a capital F that King Tom was supposed to be. He's still just trying to figure out how to fill those shoes.
When you live in the shadow of a parent, and especially a boy to a father, it's always like you're a little, the suit is a little too big, the shoes are a little too big. You always feel like you're playing dress up more than actually being the thing. But unfortunately, Jack is he's the patriarch of the family now.
You say that, but can I ask you, what changes? Like, at what point do you feel like you're not wearing your dad's business shoes and like shuffling around?
It's a good question. For some people, they never actually do. It's only when that person is removed from your life some way, either because they've passed away or because you move away and you've literally, you know, sever your life from them, or something happens, something irreparable happens that tears it asunder. But I think you get a lot of this kind of arrested development never really come to fruition when you are raised by big alpha men. There's not two male lions at the head of a pride, and lions chase off the males or kill the males that may be a threat to them, because you can't have two male alphas in the same space. It just doesn't work. When you have someone, like you said, larger than life, a real alpha dog like a Tom Spade, Jack and Ace are never going to be able to fill that role as long as he's there. And now Jack is trying to play super speed up catch up. He's trying to be the alpha dog, but just like Ace is putting on this persona that's not reflecting who he really is, Jack is kind of a scared little boy himself. He puts on, I think he walks the walk and talks the talk better than Ace. He's definitely more mature than Ace, but he's not an alpha dog. He's trying to figure out his shit too. Look at the scene where he has to sing and dance for Eddie Earl.
Oh gosh, let's get into Eddie Earl, because that was a scene.
Let's listen to this.
Oh, the good Lord rewards the prosperous with more prosperity.
Okay. Where's that from?
That's the proverb, psalm. So,
there's so many. There are, yeah, so many. You know, it's hard to keep track. But if you want to expand your brand's profile, mm-hmm, and its association with my business, you might consider doing what your daddy did. You remember our commercial?
Yes, I do.
Sing a song for me.
I'm going to save my energy for the rings tonight.
What do I pay for, Rodney?
Not for me to sing the song.
Oh, sing it. Oh, pretty please.
When your times get tough, yep, you want to sell some stuff, you come on down to Eddie Earl.
That's me. Nothing lasts longer than a jingle.
Now, I am sure Tom Spade did the commercials, had to do the things he had to do for his sponsors, maybe even sang that ridiculous song on camera for a commercial. That is a very different thing than Dance Monkey Dance in my office. You're going to come in here and tell me to sing? I can't see Tom Spade ever abiding by that. And that's the difference between who Tom Spade was and the respect that people had for him versus where Jack is at and hasn't really earned that respect yet. He's still a kid
He is absolutely being commanded around.
So what else do I pay for?
And like the Timmys of the world, you know? I mean, God. And these people are just, they're not like somebody who you actually feel the need to impress, you know? So then when they're making you do these like song and dance, you're like, but I don't even care about you, you know? Like, it's so much worse. It's so much worse. And that jingle was horrible. P.S.
It was horrible. And I mean, it's not even that it's embarrassing. I mean, I'm willing to do embarrassing things for sponsors for sure. If anyone wants to sponsor us, I'll wear MeUndies and I'll take pictures and stuff. I'm cool with that. But it's demeaning what Eddie makes him do here. It's literally like treating him like a show puppy. It even says, he's like, what am I paying for if not to have you do my bidding? When in, you know, like he could call him up in the middle of the night and say, sing for me, Jack, because I command you to.
Yeah, it's the whole like him saying no and begging off and being pushed to do it anyway. Oh, it made me cringe.
Yeah, I got a little hat tip to Mary McCormick in this scene when Jack, without her apparently having heard this beforehand, offers to expand the religious themed bannering around the ring. And she says, Jesus Christ, and then covers herself because these are religious folk. She says, would love that. It was very, very funny. An A+ on the line reading from Ms. McCormick. The one thing that stuck out to me this episode about Jack and Ace that I think could have avoided all of the tension in these last three episodes between these two brothers is this pitch that Jack makes to Ace when they're talking about the apology. He says there's more than one way to make it in wrestling. And yes, you could go up north, but you could spend years in development, never get to the main roster, and then be cut. And you're just a pawn in their machine. Stay here. Help me build what we're going to build. And you won't be a pawn. You can be a partner. We could rule this thing together, you and me, you being the face of the company. That is a pitch that Ace would have eaten up because it strokes his ego in all the right ways. Plus, it is the inclusive family, we're a team thing that Jack keeps saying he wants, but everyone keeps saying you're not letting anyone in. Why doesn't he make this pitch at the outset? He should be making this pitch to everyone. Like, let's, you know, all, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. Stay here and let's work on it together.
I think it's just that this is the time frame that we have popped into their lives. We could have come into it 2 months from now and this would have already happened and we would have been like, okay, this is the way it should have been all along. We've just come into the story when he's finally realizing like, I can't take this on completely by myself. And in fact, if other people are not invested, they are not going to participate in the way that I want them to. So I have to start giving other people pieces of the pie here. That's the only way it's going to work. I'm not so mad at it because I feel like it's just when we dropped in. It's just where we are in the timeline. This is just when he's finally decided, oh shit, I really do have to share here.
Ace is not the only one who has a bone to pick with Jack in this episode. Again, we see Rooster continues to have a gripe. He's particularly set off in this episode because Bobby Pinn, the guy who doesn't even know how to do an elbow drop, is now wrestling in the main event against Ace, a guy that Rooster, I mean, acknowledges has the natural talent, but also understands is not a super veteran. And so for Rooster, a guy who, by his own admission, is a prodigy who has been around for a long, long time, I'm clocking maybe 20 years, going on 20 years wrestling in every indie league in the South, not getting his shot in the main event. He we know he has a legitimate gripe, and we talked about this a lot last week. Does he pick the best time to try and talk to Jack in this episode? And when Jack finally does give him an answer and says, you are the best we have here and you will get a title shot, but it'll be when it makes sense for the story. Is that a sufficient answer for Rooster? Or you think Rooster is going to be happy with that?
Oh my God, when he starts talking to Jack in the hallway, I like threw my head back. I was like, no, this is the worst time. Like, why are you approaching him with this right now? No, I thought it was terrible timing. And I just don't think he could have ever gotten, but here's the thing. I don't think he could have gotten an answer out of Jack during that time of a show. Pick any old show any day of the week and say like, okay, this is when I'm going to try to talk to him mid, we have a crowd out there. This is a terrible time to try to discuss anything business-wise or story-wise. You know, sometimes kids ask you something when they know you're super busy because they think they can just sort of like get one over on you because you're not really paying that close attention. You're just so scattered at the moment.
Yeah.
It had that vibe, which was like unfortunate because Rooster's better than that. Like he could have given a solid pitch sitting in the office. So I was bummed about that because Rooster has really good reasons. When we got the history on Rooster this time, I was very impressed with his story and was like, I see why he feels like he needs to be given a real chance. But man, this was the wrong approach.
He agreed to talk to Jack only because Apocalypse implored him to do so. And he says, out of respect for you, I'll do that. I'll talk to the man and let him know what's on my mind before maybe, you know, exploring going to Charlie Gulley's, you know, Florida Wrestling Dystopia. But it seems very disingenuous how he actually goes about it in this episode. And, you know, Apocalypse says, schedule it with Willie. You got to have a sit down with the guy. Yeah, not in the middle. I mean, Jack himself is trying to run this event tonight. People are in the house, but he himself is getting ready to wrestle. Plus, they've got the Ricky Rabies special guest star here. Plus, he's got all of his bullshit with Ace, and Rooster's aware of what's going on in the locker room. So a little disingenuous if he's going to turn around and say, well, you know, go to Apocalypse and say, well, I talked to the guy. You know, I did what you said. And look, this is the answer I got. You know, in some ways, I'm surprised Jack even gave him the thoughtful answer that he did, acknowledging that he is the best one that they have, that he's got personality for days. But, you know, it's got to be the right time. That's consistent for Jack. Everything without Jack is about it being the right fucking narrative time. So you sit down and you plan out. All right. Well, when is it going to be the time? You go and you have a meeting. They're always at the goddamn dome, that we see them there at all times of the day. Go have a planning meeting. Go have a storyboard meeting. Let's work out who's going to feud with who that's going to lead to me getting the shot.
And we've even seen that how they do the meeting portions when they're like all in the ring and he's reading down the sheet. We've seen times when there's like obviously more relaxed, casual times when they do get together. And I'm not saying that's even a good time for a Rooster, because it was very clear, Willie made it very clear to keep your ideas in your head during that portion. Right. But it means that they do have these team meetings. And Apocalypse, like you said, was very clear. Schedule a time with Willie to actually go ahead and schedule this with Jack. Right. Like, come on now. You half-hearted did this and you got a half-assed response. Come on.
Exactly. And Rooster is complicated. And he's kind of one of my favorite characters because he is so complicated. He does have legitimate issues that he's right to be bringing up. You know, it's also kind of the guy who's always grousing under his breath and not actually talking to the person or persons who could be doing something about it. Jack is the only one, and to an extent, Willie are the only ones who can do it. So for me, it was a little disingenuous for him to carry it out that way. If he's going to turn around next week and be like, well, fuck it, I tried and I got blown off kind of thing. Because did you? You didn't really try in the best way. You know, he says to Apocalypse in this episode, he says it kind of low, so it's hard to hear. He says, I just need a push. And a push is when the promotion starts hyping the person. They go on a win streak. You start seeing them every single week. They're always wrestling. They're always in a ring. They're always in front of the crowd. And they tend to go on a winning streak, which makes them a contender for the belt. A lot of these wrestlers only seem like they're kind of in neutral gear right now. It's really just about Ace and whoever. It was Ace and Big Jim, and now maybe Ace and Bobby. But I also like that Jack gave him a reason. He even cut him off. He didn't even need to hear Rooster's complaint was. He says, Bobby is no one. So I needed someone that was completely blank, that the crowd doesn't have any history for, good or bad, so Ace could do what he needed to do with the crowd tonight. That seems like a really legitimate reason to me. But I don't know if Rooster's ears are opening to hearing.
I mean, I think that there's just absolutely no way that Jack could hear. And I think Rooster knew that. So I'm even going to throw it out that he can just claim he tried to talk to Jack. I mean, he knew.
All of that being said, when he says, you know, Bobby's dumb as a bag of dicks, I laughed out loud. I laughed pretty
you
hard.
Did.
What did you think of the Bobby Pin Rooster antics with the Smirnoff Ice and the whole, like, the ritual of the locker room that we got to see? I mean, this was pulling back the curtain on how these guys bond and treat each other and haze each other a little bit. What did you think of that whole plot?
I liked how it ended. The follow through of leaving it on Rooster's seat and having him like wave over at Rooster and them being like actually sweet with each other by the end, and Rooster genuinely laughing. I liked how it ended up. During it, I was like, Bobby is such a weirdo. Like, I kept feeling like, what is he doing? Like, he's putting, like, you know, a drink in the urinal. Like, just the whole thing. Or even standing on a toilet seat looking over a stall into a urinal felt like, Bobby, that's not what men do. Cut it out. The whole process of it. Oh, Bobby, I just kept shaking my head. But I like how it ended. I liked how you got the little bit of like bonding that really did happen. What did you think about Bobby in this episode in terms of, like, we got a little bit more backstory on him with his parents. He works at a strip club, which I was like, okay.
Well, he's a big dude. Sure, that makes sense, right?
It does, but he's so, like, sweet and quiet and whatever. It kind of made me laugh that I was like, oh my God. not only that, but that whole strip club scene where it ended up being a woman who was like slapping her on the stripper. I was like, oh, good Lord.
Oh, my God. When he's pulling her out and he's like, you know, just because you're a woman doesn't mean you get to hit the dancers. You don't get to spank the dancers. And as the woman's getting pulled out, she's staring Google eyed and she's like, bye, Tommy, to the dancer. The dancer just rolls her eyes and she's like, and Bobby says, yes, that's right. Bye, Tommy. And he's just like pulling this woman out. She's all Google eyed for her. I mean, Tommy is very pretty. Yeah, sure. I get it. But yeah, it was a very funny scene.
Bobby's life is so interesting. Like this,
would you ever call your parents to leave a voicemail while you're at the strip club? I can't see you doing that, Caroline.
It feels like he is this like yokel in a big town, and then it's Duffy, Georgia. So you're like, wait a minute, what? Like, where exactly could you have come from that this equals like the big city, and you're taking your big shot? I don't understand. It's like he was born in a bunker somewhere.
You know how Cabbage Patch Kids were like birthed in the Cabbage Patch? I feel
growing
like
in a garden, Cabbage Patch Kids growing in the sun.
I feel like Bobby was hatched in like a cow pasture.
Oh, okay.
And you know, like he just came out and he was raised, you know how like, you know, Disney movies have kids raised by wolves and they become like, he was just raised by really sweet cows and maybe some other farm animals a la Babe or Charlotte's Web.
He's got that Kal-El feel too, of your little egg just landed here on Earth and you like are just like astounded by everything.
Yeah, if he said Nanu Nanu, it would be on brand for him kind of thing or whatever, you know, but I think he's so sweet. I think there's something interesting here that they're laying in without really hitting us over the head. So, you know, it's not unusual for people not to pick up their phones, right, and get the voicemail. But I think there's something very specific about the fact that he's leaving a voicemail very excitedly about being on the main event, you know, at the beginning of the episode. And then the episode ends and he's had a great night. He finally got through to Rooster a little bit. He had a great match with Ace. I mean, people are going to talk about Ace turning heel, and Bobby's always going to be a part of that conversation because he was the opponent in that match. I mean, he's etched in the history of the DWL in a significant way now. So he's up on the water tower, another rite of passage, and he's leaving, but he's leaving another voicemail for his parents.
I gotta tell you, I was getting the heebie-jeebs when he was up there because, I mean, the beginning of this episode set us up for like these happy moments that turn really sour, really horribly bad, really fast. And so he's up there and he's laughing and he's smiling. And again, he's leaving a voicemail in a way that's like his parents aren't talking to him almost.
That's what I was
like, please don't jump. Like, please don't do anything. Please don't have a gun. Please don't do anything crazy. Like, it really made me like worried. They maintained his happiness throughout. He was happy the whole time. There wasn't a dip in his behavior, but the vibe of the episode made me worry for him.
For sure. And I think Trey Tucker, who's playing Bobby Pin here, is doing a great job of conveying just sweet joy. I mean, he's the definition of, I don't know if you guys have this word or phrase in Texas, but he's what I grew up calling a big galoot, a sweet big galoot. And he's the definition of that. Just a big old teddy bear, you know, who.
That's not a regional thing. That's a where you are in time and space. That's just an old fashioned word.
No, that's also me, too. he's like a big, sweet teddy bear who may accidentally break your arm or your back when he goes to give you a hug. Like, doesn't realize. You ever see like the TikTok videos or like YouTube videos of like big dogs who climb up onto your lap because they think they're little puppies? You know, that's kind of Bobby, right? He doesn't understand his size and his width and you know, and
his width. You're like his girth.
His girth.
Even though you said Bobby, you're like, oh, Bobby.
I mean, Tom just finished his production of Young Frankenstein, and so Schwarzenstucken is like in my head, you know, is having a big one. And so I'm sure Bobby is well ampled everywhere.
I think all of Duffy is just BT dubs. That's based on my assessment.
Have you received your Men of Duffy calendar yet, Caroline?
And I'm outraged.
We have to get a social media campaign going for this.
For sure. We can put this together.
A moment that made me absolutely laugh about Bobby Pin was when he's about to go on with Ace, but Ace can't be found, and Jack is scrambling because, you know, he's going to go back on, even though he just finished a match, and Willie is yelling at Jack that he's too old, he can't go do back-to-back matches. You know, they say cue up Bobby's music, and then Jack stops and goes, has anyone actually listened to your intro music yet? And Bobby says, it's a rap song I wrote myself. Made me laugh hysterically. I don't even, you hear the music a little bit, but I couldn't even hear what it was. But just that line reading, just the idea of this big galoot, he's a rap guy, like, okay, sure. And he's writing his own raps too. That I'm sure that's gonna be flawless. I'm sure it's gonna sound great.
I can't wait to expand more on Bobby's life. I feel like he is coming to the forefront and we're going to see more about him, which I'm excited for. I really loved when the group of wrestlers are together and they're dynamic, but I'm okay with us like getting into Bobby a little bit more and examining his relationships with the other players here.
I had seen through the first four episodes and Crystal was like my hands down favorite character. I think Kelly Bertland is just killing it in the role, but the character itself is just kind of fascinating to me. And I walked away from the end of this episode needing to know more about her. Let's start at the end. She's drinking that Diet Coke. It looks like a very empty, quiet house she's in at the end of the episode. What's her deal? What is your best guess about Crystal's private life outside of the ring? Because we haven't seen it yet. We don't know anything about Crystal, I realized.
I think she still lives at home. I think that those kids are not her siblings per se, but she could live with, I don't know, a sibling of her own. There's some familial multifamily situation going there, I think. I do not think she owns that home herself or lives there alone. You know, Crystal, this episode put her through the ringer. I mean, I felt for her. There was some big moments here that really, frankly, it hurt my heart. Like, I mean, I was like, Crystal, no. Like, is this actually happening to you? It's all wrapped up in the rabies, so I feel like we have to go talk to them.
We should say at the outset, Ricky Rabies is being portrayed in this episode by a guy whose real name is Philip Jack Brooks. But any wrestling fan who's watched wrestling in the last 20 years knows this guy as CM Punk. He is a tremendously popular wrestling superstar. He wrestled for the WWE from, I think it was 99 to 2014. Extremely popular with fans. He retired. He had gotten like a MRSA staph infection and he had become a little bit disillusioned with the WWE and how he was treating him. And so he retired from wrestling in 2014, said he was never going to wrestle again. He became a UFC fighter and he's been fighting in the UFC for the last 5-6 years. He just returned to wrestling for All Elite Wrestling, which people refer to as AEW, on August 20th. So at the time that this episode airs, that you guys are listening, he would have just after a 7-year absence, a 7-year retirement, would have returned to wrestling a week and a half ago about after being gone. So a great time for CM Punk to be returning to wrestling and TV all at the same time. He's really having, it's CM Punk summer, really, honestly.
It's CM Punk's world and we're all just living in it.
It's CM Punk's world. We're all just living in it. I mean, he pushed AEW. They have a brand new show called Rampage, which is their Friday night show. His return, it was the second episode, but it was the first time an AEW show had cracked 1 million viewers, was his return. The guy is a ratings draw. Just him being in the house is going to guarantee you eyeballs, which is kind of what the Ricky Rabies character is, right? That's whole Jack's reason for bringing him on. He's going to put
very meta.
Very meta. He's putting butts in seats. He does for the AEW in the real world, and Ricky Rabies does in this episode too. Holy shit. I don't think I've ever heard so much philosophizing about the importance of blood in wrestling. When he says it's fun blood, not devil blood, and then says later, it's not bloodletting, but blood unifying, as he puts his hands interspersed. I couldn't help but laughing. It was because it's so earnest. He says it so goddamn sincerely. What's your take on Ricky Rabies, Wolfgang, his son, and Vicky Rabies, his valet?
I thought this setup was wild. I mean, I understand the difference between fun blood and devil blood, though. Like, I mean, I'm not really actually confused about that. He's not using it as like that kind of blood. You know exactly what kind of blood that is. If you go like scary blood, right? This is like fun blood. Like, oh, I got blood on you. It's like that. And I could go for that. Like, I was for it. The whole relationship where like Wolfgang needs to be a part of it and he like flies that little drone with the possum skin or whatever on it. Oh my God. The entire time that was happening, I was like, no, this is not happening. It was such a funny little like gimmick to have for this family. And then of course, how could we not underscore that line of family, Vicky and her entire presentation of herself to Crystal and who she is and how she got here. And if you want to be like Vicky, here's what you need to do, only to have that line, he's got to get back to his wife. I like my jaw hit the floor. Like I was like, oh my God. After watching Crystal totally like do everything to Ace this entire episode. I mean, the whole like when she was like taking care of him, I was like, Vicky has like filled her head with a bunch of nonsense. And now check out what's happening. She's just the valet. Like I had no idea. I really thought she was the wife. Did they trick you? Did you think she was really the wife the whole time?
Well, first I have to say this.
What?
Stoke the Ravinity! Stoke!
I don't think, I can't believe I've waited 62 minutes to play that, but we have to play that much more throughout the rest of this episode, just randomly. Because you have to stoke the Ravinity.
Throughout the rest of the podcast.
For sure. It'll be loaded.
If we don't stoke the Ravinity! I could just do it for you. Stoke
the Ravinity! Stoke!
Oh my God.
That will be with us every episode going forward now. I know it was a wild turn. I didn't think they were married. I figured it was like Wolfgang was like a love child kind of thing. But the idea that there was a wife, because he even says he's like, I love traveling with my family around. Like he's like this wholesome family guy. Ricky Rabies kind of portrays himself as like the anti Eddie Earl, right? He's like, I do this, like, I've got the drone thing now, and we're making blood because it allows Wolfgang, and I love having my family on the road with me. Motherfucker, a third of your family is Betty, and she's in North Carolina, and she's gonna whoop your ass for being late if you don't get home in time. Wait, what are you talking about, my man? I was shocked. It was a great twist. I did not see it coming, but man, you have to think Crystal is watching at the end. Her jaw's on the floor. She's like, the fuck.
Well, she's been duped, man. Right? She was given this formula for like, how do you become a family? How do you make a family with a wrestler? And this is what you do, only to find out that Vicky is not this family. She's the valet and certainly, most certainly not the wife. Do you think Wolfgang is Vicky's son? I think it's Vicky and Ricky's son, right? Oh my God, it's Vicky and Ricky. I just said that. I didn't even realize.
Well, she introduces herself as Vicky Rabies. So it's not even like, I don't think Crystal uses Spade as a last name as the valet. Vicky is holding herself out as being a literal member of this family because she refers to herself. So it's presumably Ricky and Vicky Rabies and Wolfgang Rabies.
Do you think Wolfgang is Vicky's, not Betty's?
I don't know. I had assumed so, but then when he says he has a wife, I'm thinking, well, Wolfgang is Betty's wife? Because Wolfgang...
No, not Betty's wife. Wolfgang's child.
Wolfgang is Betty's child, but mm-mm. Wolfgang is old enough to know what's going on here. So either way, Wolfgang is either Vicky and Ricky's kid. And
I think so.
And Wolfgang knows that Ricky has a wife somewhere and he seems to be cool with it. Like Wolfgang is very supportive of his father. I mean, I wish Tom was as into my interests and hobbies and was making drone spit blood spitting possums with me. I would love that kind of dynamic. So he doesn't seem to be harboring any ill will, whether it's the fact that Ricky has a wife at home and Wolfgang is like, you have another family. Like one way or another, Wolfgang has to understand Ricky has two families. He's only a part of one of them, presumably, but we don't know. Maybe Betty's all cool with this. Betty's like, I don't know, the checks show up in the mail, and so...
No, she expects Ricky's ass home. So she doesn't just want to check in the mail. She is fully married to him. So.
Sure, of course, of course, of course. But unless we're assuming he's putting Wolfgang and Vicky out on the side of the road before he pulls in the driveway with Betty, Betty's got to know that this whole family exists, no?
I'm going to go with the idea that maybe this is like Ricky's weekend with Wolfgang kind of thing, like that, right? Like she could know about the kid, but like maybe doesn't know that Ricky presents the three of them as a family. Maybe it's more, you know, oh, this is just Wolfgang and Ricky time. But P.S. Same with the tuna fish and gummy eater.
Stoke the Ravinity! Stoke!
Let's talk a little bit about the match, because I actually think this was a pretty good match for people to understand what like really happens in a wrestling match. One, Jack's look where he kind of cocks his head right before the drone spits the blood at him was hysterical, and he did not know that was happening. Like, he clearly had not been briefed on how the blood was going to be introduced into the match, and I thought that was pretty funny.
But, it was.
But we got to see the two of them talking in the ring. Ricky indicates it's time to finish the match because his knee's given way, and they're chit-chatting in the ring while the ring match is going on. You got people real up close to them, and they're still talking and coordinating in the ring, but it's being done in such a way that you don't, if you weren't in there with a camera, you wouldn't have heard them.
I kind of loved all that, and it really gave the audience, especially the non-wrestler watchers, an opportunity to see like how that really happens. If you haven't had the chance to go watch The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, definitely go watch that, because it gives you a whole other side of basically how Ricky's life would be, of like traveling around to different shows, being brought in as like just like the little headliner for the night kind of thing. Really, really interesting. And all the gimmicks that everybody had, like the one guy had like a staple gun and all this kind of stuff, like all the gimmicks that they used to try to, you know, stand out and be like a crowd favorite. It was fascinating. And Ricky Rabies was like brilliantly portrayed here as like, yeah, this is exactly what goes on.
For sure. And one thing that was a nice little touch, because it's a heel move. At the end of the match, Ricky Rabies is done. Jack pins him. He, you know, he's got the leg. It's a nice roll up pin, but he puts his legs up on the rope. Now, that's a classic heels move, because the idea is when you put your legs up on a rope, it gives you extra leverage to stay on top of the body. That's a move that heels do. And so I love Jack didn't need to do that. Like, there was not going to be any kind of kick out here. But Jack just selling again. He is a heel and he cheats. And, you know, y'all stupid and I'm going to cheat just so I can win. So putting his legs up on a rope, I think, was just a really like a nice little detail. Again, I like the authenticity and the attempt at making the wrestling look real, especially in an indie setting, in an indie league setting. I think it's great. When he's out of the ring and Vicky gets into it and she rakes his eyes and stuff, and then he goes and takes Eddie Earl's beer and swigs at it. Again, I laughed out loud. It was so hysterical. He's like, what the fuck am I doing with the blood on my eyes? I got this crazy woman raking my eyeballs. I'm taking Eddie Earl's goddamn beer because I hate that motherfucker.
I know, but I love that. I love that he took advantage of being in character to do something to get back at him.
And you know, Eddie... And the Earls loved it. They were like, they were hooting and hollering. They were like, they were into it, right? I mean, he pushes Ricky into one of the crowd, sits on like their laps kind of thing. Like, that's what you get at those kinds of shows. I mean, even like even when you watch like the major promotions, like the WWE, like they throw wrestlers over the barricade sometimes. You know, they go into the stands. These guys get put in front of fans in a very tangible kind of way. So it was great to kind of see that, because if people are thinking, well, that wouldn't happen. No, that shit happens. Like, these guys are putting their bodies out there. It's not like a football match, a football game where you are feet and feet and feet away from the action. Here, you're going to get maybe blood on you. You may get wet.
Hopefully blood unifying.
Blood unifying, and I'm putting my fingers together. I'm interlacing my fingers.
You're doing that. You're acting it out. It's like when I acted out Bobby's wave at the end, like, bye, Rooster.
Exactly. All right, guys, just one more time, just because we got a feel here as we kicked out to the end of this match.
Stoke the Ravinity! Stoke!
We can't get enough of that. We cannot get enough of it. What did you think of Crystal overall in this episode? Did she feel more confident to you about speaking her mind and putting Vicky's advice into practice?
No, I think it was humiliating. I think that was the Diet Coke at home, like the what have I done? Like, no, I think that she thought she was doing the right thing and she thought she was following a smart path here. And then to be so wrong, to realize that her role would always just be like the secondhand side piece, like, no, I think she felt awful. So I will be interested to see what happens in the next episode, because I think this one was actually like a dressing down. Like, she doesn't know how it works. She actually was really taught a horrible lesson in this one.
I think actually I was referring to the beginning part of the episode where she tells him, you know, I think this promo is a little too positive. And then when she's with Jack and him and she suggests that maybe he get booed. Which is interesting, because that's actually a little bit of the turning point, because Vicky comes in when Ace turns to Crystal after she says, well, maybe you get booed and that would be a good thing. And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Vicky walks in and kind of grabs her away, which is a very kind of old school thing. Like, you know, I think Vicky's indicating there, you're the valet. You shouldn't be inputting in what the men do kind of thing.
1,000%.
And she begins to give her this tutorial, which leads her down the dark path. Crystal's instincts are better than that. Crystal's instincts are what's getting her like Jack's respect, not Vicky's.
But not Ace's. I mean, when we saw this whole thing,
Ace doesn't respect her at all.
Oh no, the whole part where he like fixes her boobs and like turns her around and does
that was disgusting and depressing.
I really cringed. That's what I'm saying. This was a dressing down for Crystal. Like, yeah, she started at the beginning of the episode with lots of talk and stuff, but by the end, she had been humiliated how many times over? It felt terrible.
Kudos to the writing on the show. They've been layering this in since day one or since episode one. when she's asking questions to him, like, are you going to take me with you, when he's getting scouted by Wild Bill, you know, and not getting an answer, but like trying to like hold his feet to the fire. She's been showing Jack what she can do. She's been giving creative ideas to Jack. I mean, the previously on for this episode was from last week when she's like, it was a real dick move what you did to your brother, but it also showed that he could be a great heel. They've been layering in a parting of the ways between Crystal and Ace. It's going to be interesting to see now with this Vicky reveal and not being a 20-year side piece, if this is like maybe the final straw to break a camel's back. It'll be interesting to see if that's what this effect is. And you're right, that Diet Coke and that exasperation with the hands on the palms on the counter and that sigh.
Oh yeah, that was awful.
Very much like I got some soul searching to do tonight.
Absolutely, it was terrible. You know who else was soul searching tonight?
Stacy.
Stacy was, man, this group of pals coming into town. What a difficult tap dance she's having to try to do to be with these gals who she obviously loves and are from another time in her life, and also be the wife of Jack Spade at the same time.
It seemed to me much more like Stacy wishes she was still living the life that these ladies are. Presumably they're college friends from a very fancy college. I got the impression that they all come from money, which makes me think that Stacy probably came from money. And so it really puts her life with Jack and Duffy. The takeaway from this episode was she's embarrassed by this life. She refers to the DWL as rinky dink. That's harsh words for the thing that your husband is devoting the majority of his life to, and by the way, the majority of your life to. Have you ever been in this position of trying to keep your world separate, where you don't necessarily want to let one side in to see what you're doing on the other side, either because you're embarrassed or uncomfortable with that kind of merging?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, but for different reasons, though. I mean, I have groups of friends who it's not about being a mom. It's not about being a parent. Then I have other groups of friends who that's all it's about, is like talking about kids and talking about, you know, what activities we're doing or something like that. So, yeah, no, I think it's actually really normal. And I think it's more about the facets of your personality. It's not really about, you know, like hiding things or keeping things away. It's like,
it's compartmentalization.
Yeah, basically, like, you're allowed to be a different girl. You're allowed to be a party girl or something. You want to go out and have drinks with your friends. That's fine. You don't need to talk about kids, and you don't need to talk about your husband, for God's sake, and whatever activities he's doing. That's not that time. I do have to say that the one friend who wears the leather dress, I was like, wardrobe, what are you doing? This is Duffy, Georgia. Everyone else is wearing the flimsiest, littlest dresses because it's hot. What are you doing? To put that girl in that leather dress, I was like, no, no, no. Even the poor girl actually says at one point, like, how hot she is, because it was like, oh my God, what are you doing? No, it did not work for me. So then this girl, then by putting her in that made me feel like, they're all trying too hard. Like, the one girl's wearing a blazer. Again, I don't even own a blazer. It's too effing hot. You cannot wear. And so then I was like, okay, are these girls just like trying too hard? Are they dressing them in this way that's like they're also living this like fictitious little life? Because I don't actually think they come from money. The one girl said she's a flight attendant. I think it's an echelon above what Stacy's life is. I think they have jobs, which automatically makes her feel like she's less than, because that's the way, I'm a stay-at-home mom, and that's the way it works. There's a real like looking down at like the stay-at-home moms, like, oh, you just like stay at home. And definitely women who work are like glamorized, and then in some way like, oh my gosh, they just have all this stuff and they're doing all these things. But it does not have to be fancy, and it does not have to be more money than they have. It's just different. How about that? They're leading different lives where they actually get to go somewhere. I think going to Machu Picchu is like, wow, that would be so fun. But I don't think they're that much fancier. And the fact that they're wearing these clothes that are like, you're trying to be fancy, but like, that doesn't even make any fucking sense what you're wearing, like, leads me to believe that.
You know, we've talked a lot about how Rooster and maybe Big Jim and some of the other wrestlers are having some grasses greener on the other side of the mountain, you know, wanderings and wanderlust. And I think this episode shows that Stacy also, either because it's a job or just getting to do things and go places that she's not being able to do, that her friends are. And honestly, Ace has also said this. I mean, he said to Jack last week, I think it was the last week or the first episode, you know, if you had a chance to go, you know, name one person who wouldn't go to New York to wrestle if they were given a shot And Jack says, I wouldn't. And, you know, Ace says, bullshit. But Jack really has never shown any. He's the only one who's completely happy with this world, seemingly. At least he hasn't let on in any way, shape, or form that he is anything other than exactly where he wants to be, which is an interesting dynamic. It's curious to have no wanderlust. Few people are entirely happy with where they are in the exact situation that they are. It makes me worry about Jack a little bit if he truly is completely sated with how things are and where he is now. You know, when we talked to Allison Luff as part of our first episode, she mentioned the fact that Stacy is wrestling with being in Duffy longer than she thinks that she had planned on being, and maybe not happy with the life that she's leading. And I think this was the first episode, and I had been waiting for this episode to really make that point again, that Allison brings that up, because this is, I think, what she's talking about. Seeing her friends from another time and then having to bring them into this world where there's no other way. She's embarrassed to have her friends there. All of her friends seem to be into it, but yet she remains uncomfortable the entire time, which was curious to me because, all right, you're embarrassed by it. I get it. This is kind of silly. My husband is a bad guy who runs around in tights and there's blood. You know, he's getting sprayed in the eyes with blood kind of thing. Like, this is what my friends are watching. But like, her friends are so into it, especially leather dress friend. I mean, she's ready to bone down with every single one of these wrestlers, including Jack.
Well, it's girls' night. That's what you do.
She's talking about, and Jack's in the promo. He's yelling at the crowd. He's being his heel self. And the leather friend says to Stacy about her husband, says, he's so fucking hot. Like, wow.
You can say he's so fucking hot to another friend. You can say it.
She said, like, I took my panties off in the car.
Because she's hot. It's hot in that dress.
And should Jack's penis find a way into me, I would not push him off.
Oh, my God. That's too much. But here's the thing. I do want to point out one other facet about this that can't be overlooked. They are running a family business. Okay. And I'm still using family in air quotes, but still it is. My dad owns his own business, and I can honestly tell you the chain that you feel like you can never really walk away from the business. You can't ever really go to Machu Picchu because who's watching the business? The amount of times we've been on vacation with my parents and or me being a kid and being on vacation with my parents, my dad has to take business calls and has to deal with stuff because he's the boss. Like, it's his business. There is that sense, too, of like, you can't leave because it's Duffy Wrestling League. So you're never going to get to leave because unless he sells the business, that's the only way. So if you are going to have a business in a town like this, you're tied in a way that these other girls aren't. And man, flight attendant, Mike, it is the most cliche thing, especially of women Stacy's age and around my age, too. Everyone talks about wanting to be a flight attendant. It is the most ridiculous, constantly used comment of like, I wish I worked for the airlines, because then you get free air travel and you can just like see the world and go do all these things. Like, it's glamorized in this hilarious way. And then when you're online, you're on Facebook or something and a real flight attendant comes on, they're like, what are you talking about? Like, we barely sleep. We're sleeping in our clothes. We're working hard. Like, it is not what you think.
We're duct taping passengers to seats.
Exactly. We're getting spit on. We're getting yanked on, whatever. It's funny how they did a really great job of grabbing these little small things. The chunky jewelry, which is hilarious because that shit that you buy at like Charming Charlie's and it's like $5. I recognized everything they were doing as like, oh my God, this is so funny and exactly what happens. Whereas Stacy, she has a good life. It's not mobile. Like, she can't really go anywhere. She's really on like this like dog leash, you know, tethered to the ground.
That takes us to this final conversation, which, you know, you and I have been talking about. What is the status of this marriage, or how much of a leash is Stacy going to give Jack before she finally pulls back and says enough? And where something has to change, where she stops being a doormat of support, an unconditionally supportive partner. We've been talking about how it has to come to an end at some point, and then we had this conversation here at the end of the episode.
Why are you picking a fight?
Only you would take "I'd like to go on vacation" as me picking a fight.
DW, I was hanging by a thread. saying by less than that if I go on vacation. And do you understand how exhausted I am?
Yes, Jack, because you tell me all the time.
Okay, well then, if DWO's a problem for you, just don't come to the show.
I have to come, Jack, because it's our whole life.
I don't understand what the problem was with tonight. You came to the show, you got to have some drinks with your friends, and everybody had a good time.
Mm-hmm. And then they got to leave.
Oof, that was like a dagger in the goddamn heart.
Yeah, that was really bad. It wouldn't matter. He could own the tractor store. He could own like any, like if you have like your own small business that is tied to a particular area, you don't have the ability to take off anytime you want. And I get it when she says that line, only you could take, I want to take a vacation, as like starting a fight. I was like, girl, you knew exactly what you were saying. Don't even fuck with me. You know, that man does not have the money and he cannot leave his business. You were exactly starting a fight. So it's like, it's so snotty, but it's so like, oh, please. She doesn't use any extra words. She knew exactly what she was doing.
I mean, yeah, she's going for the jugular here because she knows the position he's in at this moment in particular. Like, he can't do anything else. So she's just venting here, but she's venting by just walking on him with like stilettos. Just poking holes in him in a way to vent her own frustrations about where she's at, which, you know, I get, everyone reaches that point. And then we all say things in relationships that if you had the chance to maybe not immediately take back when you sleep on it and you think about it, maybe you want to take back. And I suspect in the morning time, she's going to probably feel a little bit bad about that choice of words at that particular moment. But it's what she's feeling at that point. And sometimes you guys got to say shit.
Well, and this was the perfect group of friends from a perfect group of time of college, when you're like making those, like, you know, which path are you going to take decisions, that clearly, you know, this was not that long ago. And these women are still like sort of sorting out, like, did I make a good choice? The thing is that if you took the camera and you followed one of these women back to a hotel room, they could be sobbing in their pillow that they don't have a husband and children, crying that they just want to be in a house and blah, blah, blah. Like, the grass is always greener. Nobody feels like they made the most perfect choice. And so I think that this night out was really important. I just wish Stacey's friends, I wish there had been more conversation, and maybe there will be later, where she can like kind of vent to them and have one of them be like, you have a beautiful family and a husband who loves you. Like, you know, kind of point out to her in the same way that she was picking up on all the good things in their life.
Well, they are at dinner, but I think that becomes so far in the past after they've gone through this whole episode. Yeah. Remember, because we're also skipping over the part where everyone is super psyched about like Ace turning heel, except for, and just the vibe of it, even the friends who don't understand wrestling, they know something exciting is happening and everyone backstage is excited about the turn, except for Stacey. She's got this look of confusion, like she doesn't understand why this is all happening. And I think she's thinking about it in an emotional way. She goes through her own emotional ringer, not only by having her friends see this aspect of her life that she was obviously trying to keep hidden, if not the waiter paying for her apps, you know, covering her apps and launching into a whole spiel about the league.
But kind of interesting that, like, in a way, she could have, like, leaned into that and been like, oh, it's so fun. Yes, it's just, like, small town drama and, like, kind of like you might say about, like, a community theater or something. You're like, oh, yeah, you know, I understand it's, like, small time or whatever, but it's still fun. Like, she could have played it that way. And obviously, the waiter, like, actually completely works for all of that, but you know, she chose to take it in a different way,
in a negative way. She calls it rinky dink as the way of playing it down, you know. And one of her friends, when they first walk in, she says, you're the first lady of this thing, like, get us seats, you know. Like, the friends get it. The friends are seeing, like, look, like, you run this thing, like, you and your husband, like, you run this thing. But earlier on at the dinner, they're like, you know, your husband's super hot, you've got a beautiful kid. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not hearing any of that, though. She's hearing Machu Picchu and knowing she can't go there.
But man, I swear to God, those friends, that's the type of thing you end up like going later. And they didn't ever go to Machu Picchu. Like, they thought about it, but they didn't go either.
Oh, when she's showing the pictures, she's like, you know, Isla de whatever the fuck, you know, like, she couldn't even remember like what the Spanish word was.
Lots of times things are played up, you know, in a way that you're like, OK, I bet it wasn't what you thought, what you say it was like.
We're reaching the end of this episode, and I want to put on the post-it because I don't want no time to talk about it this week. Willie brings up this idea of the screw job that Jack did to Ace, and how Ace's apology, his promo, reveals that and puts it part of the storyline. I want to talk about Screwjob next week because it's a really interesting concept as far as kayfabe goes and storytelling and wrestling goes. And there's a really famous WWE example of a screwjob that is considered one of the biggest moments in wrestling history. Certainly on everyone's top 10, if not higher. But I want to post that for next week because it's not terribly important to this week's discussion.
But then can I also add to your post-it for Willie? I really want to add in this idea that she's always carrying around this drink with the straw in it with the lid. And that whole, like, did I give you a purchase order for this? And the whole, like, what time of day was it? And it's clear Willie gets to a point of the day when she should not be making business decisions. So, yeah, I want to put a little pin in that. I was like, let's watch Willie and find out what's going on with her.
For sure. Because, I mean, I have on my notes even, you know, she authorized a purchase order. She doesn't remember. Was just a throwaway humor line, or is it indicative of something else?
I think it was indicative of something else.
And part of the Willie storyline is that Wild Bill is calling her all episode. She's ignoring his calls.
Their relationship. Ooh.
We know Wild Bill has done this viral video of wearing a championship belt. It looks like on a plane. He's otherwise naked.
That was really, really insane.
And after trying to get a hold of her on the phone, he's waiting at her house as she's pulling up at the end of the episode and says, I really fucked up.
You don't normally get that. I'm totally watching them trying to even it out of like, yeah, we saw some, you know, tits and ass over here, but we're also going to see like dicks and butts over here too. So like, wow,
we're gonna see more of it next week is all I'm gonna say. So keep your powder dry. Any of the Chris Bauer stands out there that need to see more of this man's body, keep your powder dry. Next week is gonna give you a real treat. So there's a lot going on with Wild Bill, and there's a lot going on with Wild Bill and Willie. But I want to talk about what Rooster says to Ace to close out this conversation about how his sneakers have not a mark on them. Ace goes to Jack and says, what does that mean again? And he says, it means you're a bad partner in the ring. This is a fascinating thing. And again, this is one of those wrestling terms, this idea of having clean boots. And I think it's a great encapsulation of who Ace is and how Ace is perceived. I mean, you talked about how his conversation with Rooster was saying, this is how we all see you now, as a guy who cried in the ring. Like, you can't be a face anymore. Like, that door is now closed. Like, I'm telling you what we all saw. He's also telling him here earlier in this episode, you're a bad partner in the ring, Ace. Like, Ace needs to take that to mind. So the idea of the clean boots is when you are wrestling, your boots get all marked up because you're getting knocked around. You're getting dragged through the ring. You're taking bumps. A bump is like when a wrestler lands on their back, which happens to wrestlers in active matches, happens a bunch for both opponents. Your boots get scuffed when you wrestle. And that is a mark of someone who is putting the work in the ring. And so when you have no marks on your boots, when Jack says it means you're a bad partner, it means that you're not working with the person. It means you don't bump. It means that you're only doing the very bare minimum to get through the match. You're not selling it. If your opponent hits you, you won't go down, or you won't go down in a dramatic way that may mark up your shoes, or you're not going to take any kind of injury. You're not going to take any kind of hits. The longevity of a wrestler is built around them being a good team player at the end of the day, right? Because no one wrestles alone. And so I want to put a post on this one too. This idea of Ace being a good partner in the ring is something Ace is going to have to work on if he's going to eventually be a superstar, because no one's going to want to work with him otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, but and that all goes back to Ace, you know, only looking at himself as like number one and not even thinking of this as a team or a partnership or anything, which hopefully changes after the conversation with Rooster, but also after the conversation with Jack about like, you know, you can be a partner in this. And hopefully he starts to get the idea that like we have to do what's good for the group and not just what's good for Ace. This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Thank you for listening to the Duffy Wrestling Dirt Sheet, a Heels podcast. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the Dirt Sheet at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on Spotify, Amazon. We're everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you could leave us a 5-star rating while you're there, that would be fantastic so that we don't need to
stoke the rivinity! Stoke!
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening.
This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.